You are listening to the OneOfUs.net Podcast Network. It's time for another episode of Digital Noise, where we cover all the home releases, Blu-rays, DVDs, and we do it through a filter of cedar pollen.
Yay!
Oh, poor
I have allergies.
Suffering. I'm just, there's many things in my life I've realized that I probably should be more, like, regularly realizing that I should be grateful for than I do. But one of the things I am in Austin regularly really grateful for is that I'm not allergic to cedar pollen.
I hate you. Yeah, I did the full-on normal thing where I lived here 5 years, no problems.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden,
boom, missed 3 days of work a year at least.
Yeah, I mean, knock on wood, I've been here almost 26 years and still nothing.
Yeah, you've made it.
I feel like I've
grandfathered in.
Yeah, I feel like I passed that limit where it's probably not going to kick in at this point, but you never know.
My fun discovery of the week is that there is Texas-based allergy medication. It's like specifically made for Austin cedar fever craze.
Uh-huh. Really?
Yeah.
I imagine like the trees are of a specific breed and so therefore obviously a very volatile breed. I mean, Jesus Christ. They're like, the trees down here are like, it's, they're like, if the Ents worked for Mordor.
Oh my gosh. Okay, that is an appropriately geeky and deep cut.
Well, that's what I try to do. But anyway, other than that, I try to cover Blu-rays and DVDs and just movies in general. And we're going to get started here with the first one, which is a fun little revenge indie film that to some degree feels a little bit like Blue Ruin, but if you mixed it with being sort of not so subtly about the troubles in Northern Ireland in a subtextual way, and that is called Bad Day for the Cut. This is written and directed by Chris Bau, who is also did movies Vera and The Captors. I had heard good things about Vera. I did not see it. But this one on the whole really kind of took me by surprise, almost in its entirety. I was largely unfamiliar with everyone involved with this thing, including the cast. Lead actor Nigel O'Neill, who plays the lead role of Donald, you know, really pretty impressive turn as a middle-aged,
actually,
like, you know, lower class Irish guy, farmer-ish dude, lives with his mom. Everyone kind of makes fun of him a bit because he's not that.
Because he lives with his mom.
He lives with his mom, who's much older, and like he's like, oh, but I got to take care of my mom. And his life is banal, not to put it mildly.
I would go with that. Yeah.
Yeah. But then one day he comes home and he finds that his mother has been murdered.
Like, legit, not just he finds her dead body, he walks in on the crime,
yeah,
no less.
Exactly. And without being able to stop it or catch the people involved, they come back and ineptly try to make it look like he tried to hang himself.
It may be one of my favorite bits of the movie.
Yeah.
It's just them trying to go through and actually tie a noose appropriately.
Yeah.
Just had me giggling for like 5 minutes straight.
Well, he takes out one of the guys and the other guy is just a kid. And he's like, look, I don't even know what's going on. I had to be here. They have my sister. They're basically, she's in a forced prostitution situation and I have no control over it. All I know is they're going to kill her if I don't do what they say. And the guy's like, all right, so what the fuck is going on here? Like, why is that? We live in the middle of nowhere. We're a little nobody family. Why would anybody, why would this obviously tied into some crime organization come in and kill my mom and then try to kill me? Well, there's more going on with
reasons.
What was happening with his mother and her relationship to other people than you might think. And like I said, it in a subtextual way, everything is sort of like talking about without talking about that sort of like unending series of violence in Northern Ireland.
Well,
like,
and
oh, they did this to us, so now we have to do that. Oh, well, they did that, so now we have to do that.
Well, and there's a whole section where it very much, when it goes into what happened, what the actual inciting incident was, you get this sense that everybody's just stuck in this cycle and there is no way out of it. And they just keep going back and forth. And even the ones who don't really want a part of it, they still are going to get pulled in no matter what because of extenuating circumstances.
Yeah. And it's interesting that, like, this guy ends up having sympathy for this kid and goes, okay, like, you're going to help me and come with me to track down, like, you know, the trail of people to figure out who ordered this thing and why they wanted my mom dead. In exchange, I will help you get your sister out of, like, the situation that she's in. Which is an uncomfortable relationship, to say the least. But, like, this guy is not, like, I mean, he's not, like, ex-military or anything, but he is really, like, no, you motherfuckers killed my mom and tried to kill me, and when it comes down to it, he's, you know, he doesn't want to have to torture and kill you, but he will.
Well, so that ended up being the thing that I liked the most about the movie overall, was that, you're right, he wasn't special forces, he was a normal guy,
yeah,
made the same kind of mistakes that any normal guy would do, but the what he had was a will. He was just like, no, this is going to happen. I'm going to take you and I'm going to do this, or I'm going to get this information from you, and if that involves me having to torture you, it's torture. If that involves me just making a deal, it's a deal. He just has this ironclad will to get this revenge, and then eventually to really find out what's going on behind the scenes. And that storyline ended up being kind of what held me through. And
yeah,
it's interesting. You mentioned the Blue Ruin. When you gave me the disc, I actually thought it looked kind of like the Blue Ruin cover. And watching the movie, I was like, this feels so much like an Irish Blue Ruin.
It does,
and
completely.
I was like, you mentioned it, and I look on the description, and it says Blue Ruin there. Mm-hmm. Glad I'm not alone.
And is it when you finally get to the point where you start realizing, okay, who was the person, which they reveal earlier than him discovering it, and then what their reason was for doing this, you're like, yeah, it's a cycle of revenge.
Yeah.
It's one of those, like, wow, that's fucked up. Like, I'd probably be pretty pissed off, too.
Well, and what I like, and I feel like this is early enough in the movie, I don't feel too bad of it, but I like that the ultimate villain is essentially a housewife or a mom who's just happens to be this stuck in this cycle of revenge as well.
Yeah.
And it's just, she's one part psycho crime boss and one part nice homemaker.
I definitely say this is well worth your time seeking out. It's a reasonably fast moving, funny scenario situations in a sort of black humor sort of way. You know, that sort of like the humor of violence, if you will.
Yeah.
And a story that goes a lot of places you wouldn't expect it to.
And it ends up being a lot more resonant than you would expect as well.
Yeah, I really liked it. No, I mean, this is Well Go USA, which isn't known for packing their discs with extras, and there's, sure enough, there's nothing here. Well, this is the type of film I would have loved to see interviews with the writer and director and like, hear a little bit about what they were thinking when they were putting this together. So I have a feeling that this is the movie I hope gets sort of discovered, and then maybe somebody else re-releases it a little later on with a little more solid of a release. Yeah. But honestly, this, I mean, it's a little Irish film. This may not end up, I mean, it may be just one of those hidden gems nobody talks about for
20 years. It's one of those movies that manages to somehow be a quiet little movie that's also fast-paced and funny and surprisingly violent.
Yeah.
So it toes that line very well. I agree. It's very much worth checking out. And it's short and quick enough that even if it's not for you, it's not too terribly long of a slog, but honestly, I can't think of anyone who wouldn't get something out of this.
Oh, I agree. I mean, except for maybe people who just can't stand anything that's really violent, because it does get very violent.
Although, you know, interestingly enough, I kept expecting it to get more violent.
Yeah?
Like, because of that Blue Ruin tonal comparison, I kept expecting it to hit that level.
To get that point,
Blue Ruin, like, or Green Room,
where it becomes
just, like,
shocking.
Fuck.
And it never really does.
No, it's just, it's very matter of fact, both in the style of filmmaking and the style of violence.
Yeah, it's not about getting you to the point where you're stunned at how violent it is. It kind of stays violent all the way throughout.
It's just like, okay, that's about what that would look like.
Yeah. So Kino Lorber put out a lot of interesting stuff in this load of movies we're talking about.
Yes, they did.
And one of the things they did that's always been on my, you know, if I get a chance to, I'm going to watch that sometime list, is The Executioner's Song. One of the reasons why is that this was a award-winning television two-part movie when it came out. And I remember as a kid in 1982 when this came out hearing about it, but it wasn't a thing for kids to watch.
Sure.
You know, I was 12 years old.
No, not at all.
My parents, I think, watched it. I did not. The other thing is, this has kind of been looked at as Tommy Lee Jones' big breakout role. Even though it was a made-for-TV movie, it, you know, won awards. It was treated with a lot of respect when it came out and talked about quite a bit. And it was also pretty topical because a lot of people were really talking at this point about the relatively recent reestablishment of the death penalty in America through a lot of states, where a lot of states were suddenly legalizing it again, but there was this long break when people hadn't actually done it. They're like, it's technically legal now, but we haven't actually executed anyone. Like, everyone was afraid to make the first move to do it. And obviously that led to a stack of dominoes falling. But this movie, The Executioner's Song, was based on a Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Norman Mailer, who loved dealing with shit like this in his books. And it follows Gary Gilmore, a real-life killer, who Tommy Lee Jones plays here really tremendously.
Yeah.
Like, so much energy and life he brings to this role of this guy who's not like a type killer. He's a sociopath.
He's basically just kind of a shit.
Yeah.
Like, it's... I had a really hard time with this because Tommy Lee Jones and Patricia Arquette do famously good work here.
Rosanna Arquette.
The Arquette. But they do great jobs playing their characters. It's just that, dear God, they're despicable people.
Oh, yeah. No question about it. I mean, like, if this was fictional, I don't think I'd be as interested in it, but it really is pretty close to what actually happened with Gary Gilmore had been in jail for 12 years for robbery in Indiana. He was released at 35, flew to Utah to live with his cousin, who had grown up close to him and was like, yes, of course, we'll take him in. Gets him a job with her dad. He almost immediately starts fucking up, and her dad can tell something is not going to work out here. He starts to have issues with other people, gets in fights, has trouble showing up at work when he's supposed to. He meets a 19-year-old Rosanna Arquette, who's already divorced with two kids of her own, and he gives it a token try to reform himself. But before you know it, he's stealing stuff. He's getting really wasted on drugs and alcohol. And before you know it, he murders some people in ways that were so unnecessary. But, like, there's just no reason to do it. You're like, okay, you finish the robbery, and then he kills them.
And they don't even resist. He just murders them for the sake of murdering.
Yeah. And, you know, that's actually a good portion of this movie. But that's not really what this movie is about. It's about that question of that period of the death penalty, what was happening then, which I thought was really the most interesting part, the questions this thing raises, because he was like, I've spent 12 years in jail. I'm not going to spend the rest of my life in jail. And the jury convicted me and the state sentenced me to death, you know, and I want it. I want you to kill me. And they kept trying to push back, and the ACLU and everything was like, no, we can't do this. And if I had an argument with this, I don't think they ever really accurately explored the ACLU's point of view on this thing. It was given kind of a token, well, you know, I mean, like, this is the first time, we don't want this to become a thing. And I was like, no, that was a much bigger deal, especially in retrospect when you're like, yeah, look at the fucking I mean, it started a landslide of states executing people and passing the law, you know, which is all, you know, once again, from the viewpoint of anybody who's like, I don't know if I agree with death penalty. It's like, well, this was a landmark moment, and why they were trying to say, this guy who said he wanted to die, why they're like, no, you don't get to die.
Well, and so that's actually my biggest pain point with this movie. Out of the three Kino Lorbers, this is the one that I liked the least.
Mm-hmm.
And fun fact, the discs were labeled wrong.
Yeah, I saw it here.
Yeah. I made it about 20 minutes in and was going, good God, this is going so slow.
Yeah,
I realized it.
they mislabeled the discs, apparently, with the first edition of this. There's a director's cut, which is actually shorter. It's 135 minutes and 43 seconds. And they actually added some more violence scenes to it. It's a little sexier. It's a little more violent. But it's apparently... the edits are tough. It's like, yeah, this doesn't really work in a shorter the way you cut this together. And then there's the whole length as originally aired, 188-minute one. That's the one I watched. Yeah. Did you end up going through the whole thing, or did you stop it and go to the other
days? I went to the other one.
Okay.
So once he got arrested and was going through the court trial and kind of the last 30 to 45 minutes of the movie, I got a lot more into it. Mm. And quite frankly, it might be because that was what I was really looking for when I put this movie in. Because the other two Kino Lorber movies are very much about trial.
They're super intense.
And so I was expecting that. And like, maybe this is some kind of box set. But what ended up happening is that whole first hour and 20 minutes, I was just so bored. Mm. I just wasn't, I liked the acting. I was intrigued by it, but he was such a shitheel, like, throughout every scene. Like, even the scene when he's romancing the girlfriend, they play this soft romantic music, and he's basically negging her into sleeping with him on the first day he met her.
Right. He's a scumbag.
And then day two, they're saying that they love each other and introducing the kids to the family. And
I feel like there's some television mechanics at work here that from the period of time when this came out that were like, the guy's not doing anything to make us like him, but it's like nobody told the technical department.
Well,
the people who do the score or lit it and everything, you're just like, what are you doing? I mean, there's no way we're going to feel for this guy. And it felt like a miscalculation, like, oh, okay, well, the reason we shouldn't in the last 40 minutes want him to die is because we don't want him to die. It's like, yeah. Can you possibly feel that way? It's like, no, that's not why. And they never address why you should think maybe there's a question that he shouldn't.
It has this documentary feel to it, which works, like, it worked really well for Detroit. Mm. Making sure I got the right title, but it worked really well for that because, okay, this is a real event with real people and we care about them and mm-hmm. we want to see them make it through because she was just a 19-year-old kid and he was a giant dickhead. I just really didn't get into it. But I have to admit that when it got into that last portion, did get into the court trial and they did get into him selling his life rights. And like, there's this great conversation with his lawyer where his lawyer has to hire another lawyer because he doesn't want to be conflicted because he owns a portion of the life rights.
Right.
Like, that was really cool and interesting. I just wish the movie had been more about that.
There's a point where it gets almost meta, but they're like talking about selling the rights to the movie you're watching.
Well, actually, so I had to look it up. I was like, wait a minute. Is that the director? Is he in his own movie as himself buying the life rights?
It's very strange. That whole aspect of it. I mean, I think I enjoyed it more than you did just because the main reason I wanted to see this because I had heard so much about Tommy Lee Jones' performance and I was not let down by it at all.
No.
I think it's a really fascinating, and tough role that he has to play here. And I think he does a great job. I just think, like so many things, no matter how good the people might be in it that were made for TV up to a certain point, it feels too much like a TV movie with everything that came with it from that period. Like, there's very few things I've been able to go back and revisit from the 70s, 80s, or 90s as like famous TV movies or miniseries that weren't inherently hurt in some way by that they feel so goddamn TV.
You know, I get that completely because it felt like, if I was there at the time, I would have loved the hell out of it because it would have blown me away and been different.
Sure.
But because of where we are, because I don't have that experience, and this came out before I was born, I just ended up kind of going, okay.
And Eli Wallach is Uncle Vern here.
Yes. Oh, my God. I didn't even realize that was him.
I know. Me neither. I was like, not that I put on the Wikipedia page. I was like, oh, holy shit, that's Eli Wallach. I'm used to seeing him a lot younger than this in Westerns.
Well, it's either much younger in Westerns or much, much older as the cute old man in rom-coms.
Oh, there you go.
You know, one of the two.
I don't know. I mean, I don't think this is for everyone for sure, but it is if you're a big Tommy Lee Jones fan is the main reason to see it because it's a super strong performance by him. The only extra on here is an interview with Roseanne Arquette talking about the period of time and what's going on, which is interesting because I really am not crazy about her performance in this thing. I thought it was very one note and not that interesting.
Yeah. I couldn't tell if I liked her performance and she just really played someone I didn't like at all. Or if it was one note. I wasn't quite sure.
Well, the next thing that I saw that you didn't see, I've been actually wanting to see this for a while, this movie, Thank You for Playing, since I heard an interview with the producer the main guy here, Ryan Green, on NPR, who basically his son, Joel, was dying of cancer. Mm-hmm. And he was a video game developer. And he was like, it was one of those things like the kid had already lasted longer than they thought he was going to from this tumor in his head. And, but they're like, he's definitely, he's not going to, I mean, it's a huge baseball sized tumor, man. The kid's not going to make it. It's just a matter of time. And the dad, in his way of dealing with this, started designing a game called That Dragon Cancer, where he was like recording his kids talking and him having conversations with his wife and his kids. And it's like a sort of, like, it's a very arty experience. I mean, it's online now. You can play it. It's one of those donation suggested type things.
Okay.
And I don't think it's like one of those you play to like, whoa.
Yeah. You go through it once and you've had the experience.
But they made this documentary about it, these directors, where they were following the development of it and of this kid and like the family and people's reactions, which of course some people are being complete assholes about it, like who are like, how do you, who are like, oh, that's so fucking, what a fucking use. Like, his kid's dying of cancer and he's trying to make money off a game. It's like, how do you not? Okay, so if he had written a book about his experiences as his way of dealing with it, nobody would go, what a dick. But well, because he's not a writer, he's a video game designer.
That's because, unfortunately, the really cool things in life, like comics, science fiction, and video games, are filled with giant dickheads who are just afraid of anything that has emotion.
Very true. And I felt like this movie, 81 minutes, pretty short, but it still felt kind of long. It was like, there's a point you're like, okay, but we've been over this already. You know, like it's just kind of, you feel like the movie wants to put you in the same holding pattern the family was in. And that's fine. But there's only one thing that I really brought me out where I was like, okay, that was powerful, where he brings the almost completed game to a convention for people to try it out, and you're just watching people play it and just fucking be a mess.
Aww.
Just like all these people don't even know him who are just like, you know, come out of there just crying and hugging him and everything. And you're like, okay, you can't not get a little verklempt watching that, right? All right,
well, now I have to go play the game and watch the movie.
I don't think it's a great movie, but it is an interesting story with something to say. I mean, I didn't feel like watching the movie. I got anything out of this I didn't get from listening to the 10-minute NPR interview.
Okay.
You know, I think it was fresh air. I can't remember. Maybe it was Radiolab. I don't remember. But either way, you know what I mean? It was like they did a complete story. They told me everything I needed to do. I felt emotional doing, like, knowing about it.
You got your catharsis.
The game's called That Dragon Cancer, if you want to seek it out. The movie's called Thank You for Playing. And there you go. And then there's Shadow Man. Now, I almost didn't watch this thing because I was like, I don't care. This is a documentary about some artist that was like one of those graffiti artists in New York that I'm not the world's biggest fan of that whole thing anyway. So, but like, I mean, I respect it. I like art and I like pop art. But like, you know, I mean, I get the place where Keith Haring held and why people thought like really were into him and why people really like Jean-Michel Basquiat. You know, I get it. But it was never the stuff that really spoke to me in particular. You know, everything that was even tertiary to the factory to some degree, I'm kind of like, okay, it's interesting, but, you know, the only thing I came out of that whole thing with any interest in at all was the Velvet Underground.
You know, you just like the banana.
No, that's not true. Okay, I like the banana. Ring, 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 banana album. I heard so many good things about this movie, that is about the third guy from that Haring Basquiat, like, group of graffiti artists that kind of graduated up to being really respected pop artists who I knew absolutely nothing about, who's given the very appropriate sobriquet by this film and by some people at the time of Shadow Man. This guy here, who is Richard Hambleton, you're like, who the fuck is that? If you're in New York at the time, you knew who he was. Everybody was talking about him, but he kind of, unlike the other two guys, he was like, I'm not really interested in making money.
Yeah.
And he just kind of sank like into his own world, was not good with people, was like, definitely not good with the press or with the art community.
I feel like that one documentary we watched a few episodes back, I feel like the underlying message was that he has some actual mental health issues. Although I will say that he is in so many ways the proto-artist of this era that for about 15 to 20 minutes, I actually thought this might have been a parody artist. Or not a parody artist, but a parody, not like a mockumentary. Because I missed this happening. I came in like, I was think three when all this was going on.
Sure.
And so
I should have been old enough to know about it. Yeah. I had no idea. First I heard about Hamilton.
But so I've heard the name Basquiat and yeah. that's about the extent of my knowledge of it. So
it's a good movie.
Truly
him.
Like a third of the way through, I was like, is he real? Is this? And like, no, okay, no, this is a real documentary. Okay. And then I kind of got started to get into it a little bit more.
Okay. Fair enough. And one of the things about him that I liked in particular, this movie, I actually like this guy's artwork.
So I'm curious, when they were going through and showing the different phases, you know, he had like the three main phases and the shadow stuff. I was like, well, that's interesting. I wasn't there, so I didn't really get the message or the underlying themes of it. I really got into his landscapes.
His landscapes are gorgeous.
Yes.
All his stuff has an inherent darkness to it that the other two guys didn't have at all.
I'll give you that.
At the same level. I mean, he got really famous with doing sidewalk murder paintings where he would do white chalk outlines of bodies and spatter them with blood red paint as like performance pieces. And they're actually pretty fucking neato. And yeah. the whole story behind how he was making that sort of like a cultural thing. It was kind of ahead of its time. But I actually love his shadow work, especially a little later when he comes back to it and he's really evolved his style to a point where it's just so precise and gorgeous.
Yeah, I liked it a lot more in that part. His art got a little more interesting, although that's also when you start getting into some of the issues that he had mentally, and it becomes kind of sad to watch too, because you can see him creating beautiful work, but he's never satisfied with it.
Yeah, they like these guys who had kind of rediscovered him and brought him out of like trying to keep him from killing himself with heroin, basically.
Yeah.
You're interviewing these young like art gallery type guys who are like, yeah, this guy's amazing. And then it follows this course of their immense frustration with this guy. Like, it's 2 weeks to a show that's being paid for by a famous fashion designer who's put a shit ton of money into this thing, and you have no pieces ready to go.
Yep.
And these guys are like, no, they're not done. And they're like, no, they're fucking done. It's a frustrating movie to watch.
Yeah.
And it's sad, very sad. But it is interesting to look inside the mind of this guy who probably should be remembered on the same level as these other like famous artists from that
especially
time.
If you're around during that time and you have that connection to that work. Which one thing that kind of surprised me was he went all over the world with it. And so I imagine that it touched on a lot of people who wouldn't normally think that this is who it was. And that would be nice for them to watch the documentary.
So another documentary I got to see you didn't see, and I was so excited about this because when I read the description, I was like, this sounds like the type of thing for like a documentary about part of the history of film that I'm super interested
in.
It's called From Caligari to Hitler. And this is subtitled German Cinema in the Age of the Masses. And this documentary is really looking at the Weimar period of cinema, which is basically all that like expressionistic work, like, you know, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari and Nosferatu and moving on towards that to where they kind of did the French New Wave before the French New Wave that like nobody talks about at all. Like this whole period where German cinema, where you're like, wow, they were doing all that shit like 10 years before the French were doing it. But this is like very like non-actor actors and very realistic things and no effects and like, which couldn't be any more different than the expressionist cinema they were doing right before it. But it follows this whole track of German cinema during one of its most fascinating periods, where it was really doing stuff that was much more interesting than we were doing in America. I mean, there's that one brief period where the Germans were ahead of everyone in film during that expressionist period. The downside of this whole thing is that it's taking its whole thesis from this book by Siegfried Krakauer made in 1947 that has been torn to pieces since then of being like, wow, you guys don't credit tons of shit that this period of cinema was taking from, like stuff the Russians were doing in particular.
Oh.
Like it just doesn't even acknowledge huge, really important pieces. And a lot of people, and this movie is basically just flat out the book. So it's weird they would make this movie now over a book this old that's been so, you know, repeatedly torn apart in that fashion. That being, and you know, and the movie itself has issues because it's weirdly nonlinear.
So
it keeps circling back around, like, we already talked about this movie. Why are we coming back to it again and then seeing the same shit again? And I'm like, why? What is happening? The only real advantage to watching this thing is there's tons and tons and tons of never before seen, or at the very least, never before seen where they looked good and had been digitally remastered footage from a lot of these early films that's just gorgeous. You're like, oh my God, like amazing scenes from these early expressionist cinema that you're like, wow, that's so cool. And it makes you, it will make you want to check, like, go and try and track down some of this stuff.
You know, I gotta say, I'm both disappointed and curious, because I'm with you in that I really enjoyed this era of cinema. Mm-hmm. There's some really beautiful stuff that came out of that. And I'm almost tempted to watch it just so, like you said, I can see a lot of that old footage digitally remastered. But so it's disappointing that to know that, like, oh yeah, you're only getting half the story. It's very one-sided.
And its argument is that it's supposed to be showing how the psychology of cinema anticipated Hitler and the fascists. And it does in and out, but it doesn't feel like, at least the movie, it doesn't make 1,000% convincing case either for the things it's doing. It's kind of like, okay, like, I feel like this is the type of movie that should have been more like a TV series in segments. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, that could have really gotten into it. Because as it is, it's kind of frustrating and repetitive. But hey, you know, I don't know what to tell you. These movies, maybe you should just go watch the movies and not worry about the documentary.
Probably the better choice.
Better books written about it. Well, let's talk about those other Kino titles we were talking about that we were really excited about. And the first one of those, I've never seen this before. It's one that's a little intimidating because of the length of the thing.
Yeah.
At 179 minutes. But it is the 1961 Stanley Kramer film Judgment at Nuremberg. Now, this is loosely based on the actual Nuremberg trials, to say the least. like it's not what happened.
You know, it's okay. I went into both this one and the its partner film going, you know what? I know this is like the other one. I know this is probably based on a real event. And this one, okay, I know this is a real event. But I was like, fuck it. You know what? This is just like, it's just a wonderful pastiche. I'm just going to go with it from that angle. Because holy crap, did this just knock my socks off out of nowhere.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. This is technically a re-release. I think Twilight Time put out this exact same version of this on Blu-ray not that long ago. So essentially, it's a double dip of the same thing, just with wider distribution from Kino. But that being said, this is kind of an essential. If you've never seen this movie, you've got to fucking see it.
Well, and
Spencer Tracy as a ex-judge, but who is being brought into Berlin to preside over the trial of some people who are falling into that, are they a war criminal or are they not, segment of like, okay, now there really is a question. These aren't the guys who are running the death camps, but these are the guys who are like, well, did they know about the death camps? How involved were they if they did know about them? Did they, you know, what was their actual role in these things? And it asks a lot of really fascinating questions about how many of the Germans even knew this was happening. And even if they did know and they were in this position, what would they be expected to do about it? And, you know, I don't think it's saying, well, what could you do at all? This movie leaves those questions in the air hanging because they're unanswered questions to this day. We're going to have to ask those questions again at some point. We just will.
You mean, so I was going to say, this is one of two movies that should not be as relevant as they are today.
Yeah.
That we had this week. And like, it's the movie that actually legitimately asks, were there good people on both sides?
Right.
Except the current thing is, of course, inexcusable. Back then, when it was relatively applicable, they approach it in a really interesting way. And where they kind of come down on an answer, like, I really appreciated where they went with it. They both acknowledge that, yes, you can have someone who may have been hampered with his ability to do change, and he may have been stuck in situations they were in, but they still were involved. And the way they handled that was, I wasn't expecting it to be quite so sincere and touching.
I couldn't agree more. I was so drawn into this. Spencer Tracy playing a relatively rare taciturn role for him.
He was very restrained compared to the other one.
compared to a lot of the roles he's played, he is playing a very like a guy who really wants to be, when going into this, as neutral as he possibly can, but finds himself in a position where he's interacting with a lot of people on the side who have strong opinions either way. And so you do really follow him through this story. But then there's all these other characters that you get. Well, like for instance, Marlene Dietrich plays the woman who used to live in the house where they put him up, which is this beautiful giant place, which he's kind of like humbled by. It's like, yeah. I don't need anything.
You're the only guy in this large mansion.
Yeah. But she used to live there, and her husband has already been executed for war crimes, which she's like telling, you know, she's like, couldn't be nicer to him and everything. He's like, look, I get, this is just where things are. And he's, you know, she's a gentlewoman, and she's convinced that it was completely and utterly wrong that they executed her husband, oh. You know, and he doesn't know. There's a really startling moment where he just says, I don't know if it was right for them to kill her, your husband or not, where you're like, wow, can you imagine I'm going to say that to someone when you're having tea with them in their house?
That's also right after we see some honest to God real footage of what happened. And
the first time most people had ever seen footage of the death camps of the Holocaust was in this movie.
Which just, so I was watching this with my wife while I was cooking dinner, and like that sequence came on. Well, first of all, so there's a ton of speeches in this movie.
Yeah.
This movie is basically less of an actual narrative film and more of just this intellectual discussion of varying speeches on what is moral and where should we go as far as our laws. But that sequence came on where they play the footage of the actual camps and just everything stopped. I stopped cooking dinner. She stopped. We all kind of walked in and we're like, that is it. We just watched that sequence for like, that's like 5 minutes long.
Yeah.
And just, oh,
it's a tough watch. I point out as well, Burt Lancaster in this thing playing one of the defendants, and all the other defendants are kind of like, no, this is, I shouldn't be here. This is ridiculous. You're putting me on trial for this. And he's the guy who's like, we suck. Guys, we deserve what we're getting. He is just kind of given up. And he's like, and he gets to give this speech in this film that is one of the all-time great Hollywood speeches.
Yeah.
You're just like, oh my God, did you see that shit? Well, like, rewind that. Let's watch that again.
I admit I did rewind that segment to the beginning because I didn't realize where it was going when it began. I was like, no, I want to experience this from the get-go.
There's so many good people in this, though. Richard Widmark playing the prosecutor, Maximilian Schell playing the defense counsel. You've got Werner Klemperer, Montgomery Clift, Judy Garland towards the very end of her career.
My wife thought that was Judy Garland, and I wasn't sure if it was her or not.
Yeah, it was towards the end of her career when she was like, she was on the meds and she was kind of gaining a lot of weight, and she was kind of sick at this point.
Well, she comes in another one of those, oh my God, heartfelt sequences where just feel so bad for what she went through.
Oh my God, so much so. And then William Shatner kind of playing the attaché who's there kind of like finesse, make sure Spencer Tracy's comfortable and everybody's good. And nominated for 11 Academy Awards. This was a big deal. It's like the record for I can't remember what the record for nominations is.
Well, it's probably The Return of the King now. But
that's wins, which is 12, I want to say. Although I thought that just tied Titanic.
Did it?
Maximilian Schell won for Best Actor. Abby Mann won for Best Adapted Screenplay. You know,
Maximilian Schell, was he the German lawyer?
Yeah, who was great.
Yeah, he deserved it. I was going to comment that it's amazing, like, the executioner saw him. You know, I had such a hard time with him, and he was such a despicable character, even though it was a great performance. He was kind of a despicable guy. Not really a bad guy, just doing his job.
Yeah.
But because of his stance, it made him that despicable character. And I loved every second he was talking.
Agreed.
I just couldn't wait till he came out and speechified.
Yeah, this is an incredibly well-made film that still holds up and asks questions that are very relevant today. Oh. And once again, I have a feeling we're going to be asking questions in a similar vein not that long from now.
And I will say, it looks gorgeous.
Yeah.
And Oh, man, did Stanley Kramer shoot the shit out of this movie.
Oh,
it
was
so well shot.
So beautiful. For a courtroom drama, especially. Yeah. Just like, wow. And they do a decent amount of stuff outside of the courtroom.
They do. But still, like, there's a shot during the speech from the Nazi officer you were talking about where I think the whole segment is a one continuous shot where he just circles the courtroom very slowly. And it's such a powerful scene.
So there are some bonus features on here. They're all archival. They originally appeared on the 2004 DVD release and the earlier aforementioned Twilight Time Blu-ray release. In 20-minute conversation with writer Abby Mann and star Maximilian Schell about the movie version and then the later television version that was made of it. They also apparently got a lot of kudos. There's a 14.5-minute tribute to the director Stanley Kramer that interviews some actors with the actress Karen Sharp, who was Kramer, who was the wife of Stanley Kramer, and then stuff from Abby Mann. There is a 6-minute The Value of a Single Human Being, which is Abby Mann reading dialogue from his original script with stills the movie playing over and then talks about the story, and then there's a bunch of trailers. So I really thought this is a don't miss.
Yeah, agreed. And everyone should go ahead and see it.
And as well as our sort of companion Kino Lorber film this week, because not only is it also another Stanley Kramer film, not only is also another Spencer Tracy film, but it's also another courtroom film that was nominated for a shit ton of Oscars and totally deserved to.
That is also freakishly relevant today.
Yeah. And it's also very loosely based on the original court trial that it's based on.
I will say that...
is Inherit the Wind.
Jesus, this movie knocked my socks off. Oh, this was the first of the three Kino Lorber that I saw. The title did not make me think what it was going to be. I was like, oh, it's some 60s movie.
You get to the end, you're like, I don't understand. Nobody died and left the wind to anyone.
Holy shit. Almost everything I can say about Judgment at Nuremberg, I can say to this one as well.
This is based on the famous Scopes monkey trial, where a young teacher... Bertram Cates, all the names have been changed to protect the actual people, played by Dick York. Yes, he didn't just do television and Disney films. Was teaching alongside creationism in school. He was teaching Darwin's evolutionary theory. And basically people with pitchforks and torches showed up and said, no, we're not going to have that in our town. And they decide they are going to prosecute him. And the town, which is very religious and very, like, you know, flag wavy and cross Bernie.
Well, how about like when they declare the prosecuting attorney the prophet of the Lord?
Oh, yeah.
I was just like, oh, my God.
Yeah. The prosecuting attorney, Matthew Brady, who played here by Frederick March, who's fucking fantastic, based on original lawyer William Jennings Bryan. Very similar type people, apparently. Like, both the lawyers are very closely modeled after the lawyers they're based on. He is totally one of those. Fry and Brimstone. He's almost more like evangelical priest than he is a lawyer, but he's a very famous lawyer. He's won tons of cases. He's deeply respected by lots of people, and they're like, well, this is a surefire win.
And they even talk about the fact that he was a presidential candidate for several times.
But Gene Kelly shows up as a journalist patterned after very famous journalist Henry Mencken, liberal journalist, who's like, you know, he's playing a very Gene Kelly type of role for a lot of this, where he's just kind of always got a little bit of a smirk and a smile, and he's always fucking with people and like, making them look stupid. And he's like, yeah, our paper paid for Henry Drummond to show up, who is based on really even more famous lawyer Clarence Darrow, with Spencer Tracy playing him, who's, you know, yeah, going to step in and say, no, this is, you can't prosecute a guy for teaching this thing that's been accepted as science. And this trial was something the whole country was paying attention to when it happened. And this is a very, you know, deeply focused on the drama, a lot of which is definitely not stuff that actually happened during the trial. I mean, but it's based on a play. It's funny, I'd never seen this movie or any adaptation of it, but I've read the play over and over and over again when I was a kid. I thought it was so great. Just never got a chance to see the movie or even go see a theatrical play version of it. Harry Morgan from MASH playing the judge.
yep. Which I made it halfway through the movie before I finally had to pause it and look him up on IMDb because I couldn't figure out where I knew him from.
But this is one of those movies that the dialogue is just so sparkling. It'll make you so angry watching it, where you're just like, I can't believe there's ever a time in America. And then you stop and go,
Yeah, yeah. Like I said, relevant today.
Nothing's really changed, except maybe there wouldn't be quite as overwhelming a number of townspeople with torches and pitchforks as there was.
Yeah, they wouldn't have run him out on a rail. Yeah. That's about the only change. And every actor puts in an A performance. Gene Kelly is so great as the lovable asshole. It's actually, he's introduced eating an apple.
Yeah.
And I turned to my wife, I paused the movie and went, he's going to be an asshole because he's eating an apple, and only assholes eat apples in movies. And yeah, he's like our asshole. You're kind of a dick, but we love you for it.
Yeah, it's one of those, even Spencer Tracy's not crazy about it. Doesn't really like him, but I feel like in a lot of ways, like he's the asshole he may not be the asshole we want, but he's the asshole we need.
Yes.
You know, and it's funny, like there's a moment you really think Spencer Tracy towards the end, like kind of calls him out on being an asshole, and you think that's going to be it. But Gene Kelly has a comeback that you're like, yeah, dude, sorry, but if I wasn't here, what the fuck, dude? You wouldn't have been here. None of this shit. They need, you guys need me to be the one go like, hey, you guys are all idiots.
He even has the great ending line there where he's like, yeah, but you're no different than me.
Yeah.
You know, and it rings true in that moment because the actors do that good of a job with the characters.
They really do. This is a wonderful, charmingly performed movie with so many great speeches in it and so many great moments between the two primary actors, like having at each other. It's thrilling. This is just an exciting movie to watch. Yeah.
It's something that I feel like you could put on and show people who don't actually normally trend towards older films. And the transfer is just note perfect. And it's also shot amazingly well. It's a gorgeously shot film.
It completely is. Nominated for 4 Academy Awards, although it didn't win any. This is another one of those movies that if you haven't caught yet, you owe it to yourself to go check it out. Here's a movie you did not get to see that really, wow, surprised the hell out of me how much I enjoyed it, called The Teacher. Set in 1983, they bring in this new teacher named Maria. And I want to say it's in Russia.
A Russian-looking name.
Yeah. Who we realize as this starts going along, because she starts off going, okay, everyone, all the students in my class, stand up, tell me your name, and tell me what both your parents do for a living. And she writes down in her little book what all her parents do. And you realize she's blackmailing the parents in a passive-aggressive way, not an openly this-is-what-I'm-doing way, but with basically giving their students good grades in exchange for favors of whatever they're able to give them. You know, whether, I don't have a job, I can really help you, but I could keep bringing you food, you know, stuff like that. And it devolves into a thing where, or goes back and forth from a thing where there's a parent-teacher conference where they brought in all the parents and a few of the teachers who are deciding whether or not to dismiss this woman. And half the parents are like, absolutely not. Like, no, my student's doing great. And the other half of the parents are like, yeah, you're fucking rich. You don't give a shit. It doesn't hurt you to go, well, yeah, come to my store and grab some stuff when you need to go shopping. I don't care. You don't give a fuck. We got nothing to give her. And our child who's working their ass off is getting nothing like from this. And it's a very upsetting film. And I'm, the surface, it's just upsetting as it is to watch because you're like, God damn, fuck this lady who never acts anything up until when it gets close to the end. But like just the sweet teacher, she's just constantly playing so nice, so almost cloyingly sweet. But everything she says is this loaded, passive-aggressive, serpentine statement. And ultimately, this is actually a metaphor for what's going on in Russia.
Well, I was going to ask if this sounds like something that's based off a true event.
Well, she's also one of the people everybody's afraid to do anything because she there is the member of the Communist Party who is there in the who works for the school, and everyone's afraid to fuck with her. But it's about how the Communist Party was like, yeah, you say one thing, but you're doing something completely different. You're just thoroughly corrupt.
Yeah,
you're still causing the class divide just as much as capitalism does. You're just doing it in a sneaky, underhanded sort of way. I thought this was a really fascinating foreign film. Just came out in 2016. It's from the Czech Republic, from Slovakia. And I thought this was mesmerizing. Such a strong performance from the lead actress here, who I believe was Zuzanna Mauri. Just, wow. This is kind of, it really did kind of wow me, and I recommend everybody
check
it out.
I'll have to check it out.
It's called The Teacher. Very good.
Although I'm loving how the theme of this episode seems to be politics.
Yeah. And trials of a sort.
Yeah.
She's kind of on trial here with the families. And then we have nothing to do with politics or trials.
Nope.
The Hong Kong movie Shockwave, which is the... Every week we have a new Andy Lau film to talk about because
pretty
the
much.
Dude apparently is trying to buy 8 new swimming pools or something. I mean, he's a legendary Hong Kong actor who mysteriously has barely aged at all since the 80s when he got his start. I mean, he's still...
Oh my God,
young,
you're right.
Handsome,
he has been around since the 80s.
Yeah, he's been around for a long time. He's been in a lot of classic movies. And I actually, despite, you know, how silly a lot of this is, I found this relatively gripping and kind of fun. Yeah. It's like what's the Catherine Bigelow film with the bomb disposal guys?
The
Hurt Locker.
The Hurt Locker.
It's like The Hurt Locker if it was a silly big Hong Kong action movie. Well, it's called Shockwaves, by the way, which I had not previously said.
And I have to admit, I'm almost there with you. The first two thirds of this movie. So basically, he's a bomb disposal guy who in the beginning is undercover, which, okay, bomb disposal guys go
it's
undercover.
Like, wait, what?
And he gets involved in stopping a bank heist, which is phenomenal, by the way. Thoroughly engrossing. Bad guy's brother goes to jail, and bad guy gets away. Fast forward a year later, the bad guy basically takes over the tunnel between Hong Kong and China.
Yeah, mainland China.
Yeah, I'm
one of the three tunnels.
I know you've been, so you know more than I do.
He took the tunnel that is the cheapest to go through and also takes the longest.
Yeah.
So.
And holds everyone hostage and says, you need to let my brother go or I'm going to blow it up and kill everyone here.
Yeah.
And so that's basically the movie. And I have to admit that up until a point, I was totally on board.
Mm-hmm.
The meet cute between him and the girl he ends up with, really thought it was cute. He basically is at a bar and she is shit-faced beyond belief. And he has to take her home to keep her from, like, killing herself in the road.
Right.
So that's cool. I like their relationship. I like him as a character. The action was really interesting.
It was well shot.
So there is a point about two-thirds of the way through the film where you find an additional motivation that the bad guys have, and things start getting, I guess, financial. Start getting into bigger picture, the whys.
They pull a Die Hard with a Vengeance,
and,
which is like one of those, like, oh, it's not about that.
Yeah.
We thought it was about that. It's actually about this other thing.
And it just completely unraveled for me. 100%. Like, there's even a point towards the end where they made a comment. The villains released a statement that if their demands aren't met, they're going to kill someone else in 10 minutes or in another the next day. But they haven't made any new demands.
Right.
And I was just like, but... So what's going on now? And it just felt like it was spinning its wheels, and then it got sillier and sillier.
Well, that's the thing
where,
I was enjoying it on that silly level, though, because for what it was, I mean, despite the implausibility level, which right from the get-go, you're like, why is a bomb disposal guy going undercover? And why did he do as much shit as he did before they were like, okay, now we're stopping you?
Yeah,
you're just kind of like, they're already fucking planting bombs on shit. You're like, why did you make the bombs work?
And he's undercover for a year.
Yeah. Like, it's like, wait, I don't understand. Who's running your undercover program over there? Anyway, there's lots of silly stuff, but I actually, you know, despite those things, and despite even, like I said, it's sort of like stealing a plot element from the Die Hard 3,
yeah.
I was like, okay, I still had a really good time with it. It does get really dumb in the last 10 minutes or so.
It does have one of my favorite arms cutting off in the entire year, though.
It's
so that
true.
Was good.
Yeah.
That kind of came out of nowhere.
It was very disarming. Right?
Damn it, I knew you were going to go there.
I don't know. I thought this was a better than average Hong Kong film, and it depends, as so many Andy Lau Hong Kong releases do, on the fact that Andy Lau is one charismatic motherfucker.
You know, I can't deny that. And the action is well shot. The explosions are cool. As much as I didn't like it, I would still say if you really enjoy any kind of Asian action cinema, it's worth a watch at the very least. You know, like, you're going to get some fun out of it.
So another film I got to see you didn't see was Miss Zombie, directed by controversial art director Sabu. I had actually heard terrible things about this movie from a couple friends who saw it at Fantastic Fest, and I did not see it when it played there a couple years ago. But I was surprised that I went, huh, everything you tell me you didn't like about this, I feel like you just watched this wrong or something. A lot of people were like, wow, this is so sexist and misogynist. I was like, I saw a movie that was a... The point was to address that.
It's like, it's a... No, no, it's about sexism and misogyny.
Yeah, I was like, totally is. I completely kind of was confused at how one would take it any other way, but whatever. It's a near future. There are zombies, but in Japan, but there are apparently levels to which you can be infected, basically. And there's like low-level zombies, which are treated as cattle. They're treated as slaves. You can use them as house servants and shit. As long as they don't eat meat, they're usually under control.
Okay.
Right? You can feed them rotten fruits and vegetables. And they're kind of, they can perform basic tasks, but they're kind of, you know, their eyes look weird and they kind of shamble around. They don't really feel pain. And you follow this family who's just gotten a young lady zombie in their life. And you watch as people just do horrible shit to her. You know, like almost every time she goes home, this gang of toughs like shoves a, like stabs her in the shoulder with a screwdriver. And she just, see her get home and she just kind of takes it out emotionless and puts it away. And you're just like, okay. And, you know, of course, this does get to the point where you start seeing people as well, because she, except for her eyes and a couple scars on her face, is a pretty attractive young lady, very attractive model in real life. The actress who playing this lead role here, Ayaka Komatsu, she's gorgeous. And, you know, she gets raped, but she's totally like, I mean, she's like, it wouldn't even, she's a zombie. She doesn't even have any response.
It doesn't register for her.
Nothing registers for her until something happens to the family's young child, where basically he dies in an accident, nothing to do with her. And the mom is like, bite him now, bite him, you know, because him being a low level zombie is better than him not being alive at all. And him as a low level zombie comes back and immediately bonds with the zombie, not the mom. And
okay,
it starts causing issues, you know, emotional issues in the family, and starts waking up something in the zombie, waking up her humanity again.
This seems densely packed for an 85-minute movie.
There is a lot of stuff that happens in it. I didn't find this boring at all. It's gorgeously shot. I will agree that it's certainly controversial as fuck. Pretty much all the so-called rape scenes are off-camera.
Oh, that's just good. Like,
there's nothing super graphic about this at all. There's a couple, a little bit of gore, but that's about it. This is definitely about the role of women in Japan and the way that they're treated. I mean, there's no question that this is trying to say something about the situation as is by being shocking. And I thought it did a pretty good job of it. I don't think this is a Miss Zombie is a must see, but it's definitely a really interesting film that doesn't really resemble anything else I've seen in horror.
Well, you know what? And that alone means that it's probably worth checking out. Just because
I think, especially if you like art horror a lot anyway.
Why not watch something new if you can?
Well, speaking of horror that's new, that I think everyone pretty much enjoyed on the whole, is the film adaptation that I was dreading. I'll tell you flat out, dreading
this. I'm right there with you.
Of It, Stephen King's It, now known as It Chapter 1, because they did the thing that everybody was like, what? You're going to do what? Which is divide the incredibly huge tome of It into two movies, one where all the protagonists are child-aged and one which hasn't come out yet, where they're all going to be full-grown adults. In the book, it goes back and forth between these two time periods. In the miniseries that Tim Curry played evil clown Pennywise, it went back and forth between the two time periods. This new film, directed by Andy Muschietti, who really at this point was only really known for directing the mixed reviews, but I really liked it, Guillermo del Toro-produced horror film Mama, starring Jessica Chastain.
That was really good, actually. I enjoyed that, too.
I liked it quite a bit myself. I know some people did not. And then you got Cary Fukunaga from True Detective was one of the script writers of this thing. There was stuff that sounded like it was going to be good. And there was a lot of stuff I was like, well, I don't know. Let's face it. This movie was a massive fucking rollicking success, at least in terms of the overall with fans and with money. $35 million budget so far brought in $700 million.
This is easily top four favorite movies of this year. I think in our best of the year podcast that we did, this was one of the first things that I listed as my favorite things that happened this year. This blew my socks off when I saw it.
I did think this was really tremendous. A lot of it had to do with just incredibly well-scripted scenes with the kids and great young actors who had a lot of chemistry together.
Yes. Well, and so I mentioned this in the other podcast, but one of the things that I really liked is, well, they managed to make the girl character kind of the stand-in for how women and little girls, as they mature, are treated and have this sexuality forced upon them.
Yeah.
And it does such a great job of showing her trapped in this situation, but at the same time, showing the boys having their, like, sexual awakenings happen without ever actually sexualizing her.
Yeah,
or perving out over her.
So thankful they left out the scene in the book of them having a basically a gangbang, which happens in the book. Yes, that actually happened.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They all have sex with her.
And one of them, so I have to tell you, I went and listen to the book because of this movie. I was like, yeah, I'm going to do it. I'm going to finally finish this because the Tim Curry thing fucked me up as a kid and I've been terrified of clowns, so I'm going to face my fears. Oh my God, I hated the book.
I read the book right when it first came out and everyone was raving about it and I was like, there's stuff in this I really like, but I don't understand why you guys are calling this like Stephen King's best book. This is a really uneven, all over the place novel with a not great ending.
No. Yeah, the ending is horrid, but for all that the book is horrid, like, the movie just nails it. And admittedly, there are a couple of things that they do towards the end of the film that I wish they hadn't. Mm-hmm. They drift a little bit into Damsel in Distress, which that didn't need to happen.
Right.
And there are a couple of character motivations that get shifted around that make me curious of how the sequel is going to happen.
Agreed.
Just because it changes, like, there's a instead of the one kid being really into Darius' history, it's the black kid in the group. And that's kind of the key part of why he stayed and what he does later on. And so I'm interested to see how that plays out. But those small nitpicks aside, this movie scared the shit out of me. It's effective. The actors all do a great job. The gore is handled really effectively, as is the dread. And my favorite little tidbit is that, and I didn't notice this till I was watching it at home with this, is Pennywise is always looking at the characters with one eye, and the other eye is always looking into the camera at us.
Yeah, which actor, Bill Skarsgård, who I thought just nailed this, apparently they were going to do it with a prosthetic, and he's like, no, I can actually do that.
Oh.
He's like, I know how to do that. And he was actually doing it. He can make one eye look off like that.
And I got to say, like, so when they when they released the promotional material for Pennywise originally, I was like you, just, oh, that is everything I don't want to see. Because he looks terrifying and he's supposed to look sweet. And, like, that's why he's so effective. But they managed to make it work so well.
Oh, yeah.
The Pennywise is just note perfect.
I mean, this is among the best Stephen King adaptations now.
Yeah, agreed.
For no question for me. And for those of you who've already seen this, and you're like, yeah, get to the bonus features. There are a decent amount of bonus features here, although they've already announced there will be a re-release of this at some point in a director's cut, if you will. But there are a lot of deleted scenes that I presume will not be included in the director's cut from what I've heard that are here, most of which are – they're just okay. There's nothing really essential except the first one tricks you into thinking it's a deleted scene, and it's not. It's a gag where it's the very beginning where the kid is like sees Pennywise in the sewer and is like, you want your boat? And the kid just grabs it and runs off, and Pennywise goes – well, shit. And that's the clip. I was like, that's awesome that you trick people with that. But there's a lot of good stuff in here. Especially the stuff that's specifically about Skarsgård playing Pennywise. The interviews with him and with the director talking about how they developed this version of Pennywise are absolutely fascinating. You see why they came to the conclusions that they did, which makes this character so different from the way he's been portrayed previously by Tim Curry. And you realize these guys know what they're doing. Also, a 15-minute piece on all the kids and how they got them to sort of build that camaraderie together. There's a new interview with Stephen King for 14 minutes where he talks about what he was thinking when he was writing this book and what he was trying to do. So it's actually a solid amount of stuff, but I will once again point out, I suspect, and probably around the time the second film comes out in 2019, we're going to get another re-release of this director's cut coming out.
Well, until then, I think I can safely say this is my pick of the week.
Okay.
Now, there's one other movie that I think was a better film that we'll talk about. but this is the one that I will watch more often than any other movie we watched this week.
Fair enough. A re-release that came out for a film, I was kind of like, do I want to see this again? I can't honestly remember how I felt about this when I saw it, but I feel like I've always said, yeah, it wasn't bad. And now that I've seen it again, I go, yeah, it wasn't bad.
It was okay.
It's SWAT. This is a 2003 film. And the main reason I wanted to see it is because, like, oh, wow, there's a great cast in this thing. And, like, I kind of want to, like, all right, so maybe it's pretty good. Maybe it's good. I mean, you've got Samuel Jackson, you got Colin Farrell, you got Michelle Rodriguez, you got LL Cool J. I'm just like, all right, that's a cool cast right there, people. That's a good lineup of folk. Jeremy Renner is in this thing before anybody even knew Jeremy Renner is playing.
Oh, he's so baby-faced.
Yeah, he is.
I just wanted to pinch his cheek.
And this is, you know, was one of those, okay, there was a very successful television series of SWAT in the 70s, and this was an attempt to capitalize on that, sort of remixing the SWAT theme into it, even though apparently the characters are aware of the existence to the TV show,
yeah.
Even though they share the names of the characters from the TV show,
yeah, they literally reference
sing
it.
The song. You're just
so this was in the, I want to say early 2000s,
yeah,
when that was the thing.
Yeah.
They went in and took all of the 70s and 80s TV shows and made okay movies about them,
because
there was like Starsky and Hutch, The A-Team, SWAT, Charlie's Angels, yeah. 1 and 2.
It was the
like,
thing. They were doing
it like
it
a dozen of them. It was like comic movies now.
Yeah. Yeah. Umu was no longer sitting. He was standing straight up and taking a paycheck.
Yeah. But I will say, like, it was really interesting watching this now.
Yeah.
With the current political climate with our police.
Yeah. Because
so it was just like, holy shit. Like, that.
They're kind of pieces.
I guess
of
they're
shit.
Good guys,
yeah.
But
you're like,
not really?
And the movie never makes the argument they probably shouldn't have done that.
No,
when they're breaking the rules, and you're like, dude.
No, but there's like one guy. It's a joke. He doesn't make the team because he doesn't eat a hot dog and isn't willing to break the rules to beat some dude up behind a crime scene.
Right, right.
It was just like, what the fuck?
I mean, you follow Colin Farrell, who is like the total badass, who was a member of SWAT, but when his partner Jeremy Renner openly disobeys an order and fucks things up, he's kind of held to account as well. Renner's let go. He is told, okay, you get to work in the cage, the place where they give out all the supplies to the SWAT team members.
The boss literally later on says, no, he's on my shit list. I don't like him.
Right.
Like, I want to fuck him up because I don't like him.
Samuel Jackson is the guy who's like used to be the badass, had kind of gone somewhere else for a while. They never really say if he retired for a while, he's just doing something else. Who knows? On vacation. But he's come back and everyone's like, whoa, it's that guy. And he's like, I'm going to put together my own SWAT team. The captain's like, all right, fine. I don't like you either, but I guess I got to do what you say because you're awesome.
Because reasons. Because
you're Samuel Jackson and you'll say fuck till I have to stop. And he's like, I will. We'll have this Colin Farrell kid on my team, and so on. It's okay, you can, but if you fuck up at all, you're all done forever. You all hand in your guns and badges. You know, whatever. Anyway, and there's a lot of inherent sexism, like the Michelle Rodriguez being the member of the team, which you think they're going to play more for, like, see, chicks are just as badass as dudes, but to some level, they do kind of put her as woman in peril a little too
it's
often.
It's funny, like, they... I feel like at the time this was really progressive.
Oh, sure.
It's really progressive in that every time she walks on screen, every single guy goes, a woman?
Yeah.
What?
And it just comes up over and over and over
yes.
again. And she's never incompetent at all. She's very good
no,
at her job or whatever. But it's like, okay, we get it.
Yeah.
And this is, I mean, yeah, it's predictable. There's no way you're not going to figure out who the main villain is way before they tell you who it is. It's just everything falls into place in a way that this was copying movies that came out before it,
yeah.
and tons of movies have copied it since.
But at the same time, like...
It's very competently made. It's got decent
action's
action.
Fun. And,
yeah.
and I got to say, this is the same era that Colin Farrell was in a bunch of these movies. Like, he was in The Recruit and this and two or three others.
The Recruit is much better than this.
It is. I really enjoy The Recruit.
I did
but
too.
Colin Farrell is really good. And LL Cool J is actually kind of good as LL Cool J.
Agreed.
And, like, none of the actors come in and put in a bad performance. So it's fun to watch. It's a Sunday afternoon or Saturday afternoon on HBO kind of movie.
Well, Mill Creek put this out in 2006 on Blu-ray. Not the first release, but there was nothing, no bonus features on here, which is weird because when this originally came out on DVD, it did have bonus features. So this is the first version of the Blu-ray out that reincorporates back the commentary tracks from the DVD with one with two commentary tracks, one with Samuel L. Jackson, LL Cool J, Brian Van Holt, Josh Charles. Forgot to mention he was in here as well. Jeremy Renner, Michelle Rodriguez, and director Clark Johnson. Director Clark Johnson, I'm sorry, is just the one by himself on the second one. So, with the writers. You know, I mean, you have two different kinds. You have the fun, everybody joking around one, and you have the one, oh, this is where we're getting to all the technical aspects of how we did this. So it depends on what kind of thing you want to... I can't imagine I would personally go back and go, I can't wait to watch this with the commentary track.
You know, it's interesting. But I didn't realize David Ayer wrote this movie.
One of that, the writers.
Yeah. That makes complete sense that this is an early David
Ayer
piece.
It's a very David Ayer film. No question about it.
Like, looking back, I'm not like... You could have told me he directed this, like this was his first studio movie. And I'm like, yeah, that makes sense.
Wouldn't have been surprised in the slightest. All right, so the question remains today. If Mystery Science Theater has done a movie, should you re-release a pristine edition of said movie without Mystery Science Theater on Blu-ray with special features? That question is still up in the air as we encounter this new Blu-ray release of your The Hunter from the Future, which, yes, Mr. Sensei did an excellent job doing their version of this truly terrible 80s, almost inexplicably bad 80s film that definitely is Italian-French-Turkish co-production. It's funny. the Turkish stuff is on the... If you've watched a lot of the weird Turkish fantasy stuff, you're like, oh my God, I totally see how your Hunter from the Future was. But a lot of people encountered this 1983 film during the same period they were watching stuff like Beastmaster, where it was playing a lot on like those cable stations like HBO and Cinemax. Yeah. And it's just not a great movie at all. Reb Brown, who's one of the few people who bothers to come back to do a bonus feature for this thing talking about the film, is, I mean, you watch this, you're like, okay, it's a barbarian movie. We know a barbarian movie, right? It's a barbarian movie. He's a barbarian. He's the badass blonde barbarian who every time he encounters other barbarians and sexy cave women, they're like, dude, you're kind of awesome. I mean, it's basically 10,000 years BC, but like without the other bad tribe he was with first. You know? And you're like, okay, so he's a badass and he can beat up dinosaurs.
I have to point out, delightfully not real dinosaurs, because the very first dinosaur is a Triceratops with stegosaur scales and tail and sharp T-Rex teeth.
Yeah, very strange.
And it's one of the bloodiest fights I've seen with an animatronic in a long time.
It is strangely gory for an animatronic.
Like, the rest of the movie is not, but that one fight is.
But there's a lot of, like, I mean, so much of this movie is them, they bond with other tribes through how awesome Yor is, and I mean, even the whole thing from 10,000 Years BC, where he saves a little kid from a dinosaur, you're like, wow, that's the same fucking thing from that movie, from both versions of that movie. They used it again. And then, all of a sudden...
and then the last act happens.
Yeah, the movie decides that apparently he is... Yor's parents were from a group of nuclear holocaust survivors that Yor's world is post-apocalyptic Earth after the nuclear holocaust. There is a Darth Vader motherfucker who... Actually, the stormtroopers look like Darth
all
Vader.
The stormtroopers
he looks like
Darth
more
Vader.
Like Ming the Merciless or
there
something.
There we go. That's what he is.
Who's taking control of all the remaining nuclear tech, and he's got laser guns, and he's got the army of Darth Vaders, and he's got psychic powers or some shit. I don't even know. And it turns into a thing with Yor and some scientist rebels and who look like they're rejects from Logan's Run, and the cavemen, his cavemen friends invade the underground lair of the guys whose minions can't hit the broadside of a barn with a laser gun, even though every time a caveman picks up a laser gun, they just cannot miss.
So I have to admit that once it got to the climax of the movie, I really didn't remember what was going on anymore.
Yeah.
The movie completely lost me the plot.
Yeah.
But I was kind of okay with that.
It's like, just so
as a rule, I don't believe in the bad movie complex. Like, the movie can be just so bad it's good. I like movies that, like, you can see that people put a lot of effort and care into it, and then it just, they didn't do something right, and so you see that passion, but I rarely believe in watching a movie just because of how delightfully terrible it is.
Yeah, agreed.
Having said that, this is that kind of movie for me.
Okay.
So, like, I was watching it, and I acknowledge it's bad. It wasn't, or I would never watch this again on my own. But I would totally get a bunch of beers together or like smoke some weed, drink some booze, and watch this with a bunch of friends.
At Walmart for $5.
Buy it.
By all means. This is, and you regularly have friends come over for Bad Movie Night. You're going to be the winner that week for Bad Movie Night.
Oh, yeah, you will.
It's not boring outside of being a really bad movie. I mean, it moves relatively quickly. There's lots of sexy half-naked chicks in it.
Although
it gets so – don't let anyone know about the twist that's coming because they'll be like, wait, what the fuck just happened? Did we change? Movies?
Although, hold on.
Is this a sequel?
Fair enough. Fair warning, the Blu-ray menu ruins it.
It does.
And it does have the best theme song that I've heard in a long time because it's Yours World and He's the Man.
I always post what I'm watching on Facebook with that little function they have on there. I posted it and somebody quoted the song and I was like, that's sad to me that you know off the top of your head the lyrics to
I have the feeling that it's got to be like Cargill or Bryce Salisbury because I know that they watched this movie
all the time. No, it was not, surprisingly. I just like, okay, oh my God.
No, like, I mean, so it's not a good movie, but it's definitely worth checking out if you like that bad movie theme.
I guess so.
And I admit, like, there was a period I thought it was going to be really interesting and they were going to have him be in like a poly relationship because he has like
it does feel like that's where it's
like
going.
Four different women throw all, themselves and the men are all like, yeah, dude, people have like multiple wives, no big deal.
But the girls ain't having it.
No, they're all like, fuck that, you're my man. And every time he meets one after that initially, he's like, no, I'm her man.
Yeah. No, the one girl is like, no, you don't. Every time any new girl shows up, she's just like, I don't like her.
Yeah.
Like I said, there's just an audio commentary track with actor Reb Brown here who, like, has a lot of fun looking back at his one moment.
I would hope he does, man. Yeah. It's worth it.
All right, so our last film this week, diametrically opposed in terms of sci-fi movies against Your Hunter from the Future.
In every way, shape, and form.
Is the film that, yes, I'm going to call it a modern masterpiece, Blade Runner 2049.
I'm with you entirely.
Now, I know a lot of people who just don't like the Blade Runner movies. And I get it. They're very slow-paced, very atmospheric. They're not the type of films that you watch if you don't feel like sitting around and thinking with the film, paying very close attention to what's happening. And that's fine. Not everybody wants to watch films in that way.
Well, they have a plot. They have an interesting plot, but it's not really just about the plot. It's about that bigger picture and that bigger question.
I mean, outside of some things in the original Blade Runner that definitely haven't dated well, like him essentially forcing himself on Rachel.
Yeah.
I found an unusual amount of people who didn't really, who were like, I was never crazy about the first Blade Runner, but I loved Blade Runner 2049. I don't know if I'm going to say if it's better or not, but I will say it's definitely at least on the same level, brought by Denis Villeneuve, the director who just last year did my favorite film, Arrival, which I thought was also just a modern sci-fi masterpiece. Blade Runner seemingly does the impossible. It takes this movie that has, it's been 35 years, you know, and makes something that feels organic to it completely, takes the main star of that and doesn't even have him show up until the last 40 minutes of this 3-hour movie, and yet never fails to engage you and ask new questions that build out of the questions the previous movie asked.
And, you know, like, it made the original better. Mm-hmm. Actually,
I agree.
Because the things you learn about those characters from the original movie just recontextualizes that entire thing. Mm-hmm. And so, so when I went into this, I think I've seen it now 3 times. Mm-hmm. Just because I keep watching it over and over again. It's gorgeous.
Yeah.
It is easily the best shot movie I've seen this year.
Okay.
The sound design.
I mean, I think no question. Yeah. Roger Deakins, who may be our best living cinematographer right now. This is maybe the best thing he's ever shot.
He continues to be the only cinematographer that I will go see a movie exclusively because he's in it. Like, oh, it's a Deakins movie. I'm in.
Yeah.
But Ryan Gosling does a great job in it. And
I wanted to comment on that because a lot of people have sort of decided they don't like Gosling anymore. And they're like, once again, to use the word taciturn, that's his style.
Yeah.
He's kind of, a lot of his performances, they're kind of micro-expression performances. He's not a guy who goes to extremes. He's very sort of sleepy look to him. And maybe for the first time in his career is a role where that's exactly the guy you want for the part.
Well, he you're right. He does play essentially the same character. Well, emotionally, that he's always men who are so withdrawn from everything that he's just, it's pure physical reaction. But having said that, there's a love story that he's involved in that, admittedly, like, I've heard a lot of flack on that regard, that plotline being sexist, but I have to admit, that was one of the things that really got me into the movie. It was so beautiful.
It's another one where I'm like, how do you not see that this is also making a comment about the way that women are treated?
Well,
like, I saw someone getting offended that the, you know, new / old Vegas in this had giant naked woman statues. And I'm like, wait, that offended you?
Yeah,
it's like, supposed to be fucking Vegas in the future. What do you think it was
going to
look like?
It's actually funny. I didn't realize they were going to Vegas until I saw the naked ladies. And I was like, oh, it's Vegas, clearly.
I was like, come on. Like, what exactly about that offends you?
And so, like, the romance plot there, so that's also one of my biggest complaints, is there is a moment where you go, oh, this is what's going to happen at the end of this storyline, and that's exactly what happens. It's so obvious. But there's a sequence that happens later on where it kind of comes back in, and it's just a simple advertisement. But because of watching what had happened with that character and where they had grown, it was one of the more poignant and painful moments of the movie.
It is. It's a guy coming to terms with his own fact that he's never going to be a real boy.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, the mystery of the movie totally had me hooked.
Yeah.
And it had me hooked in a way that every time I saw it and went, oh, I bet that's what's happening, he went, oh, I bet that's what's happening. And then every time he found out new information and went, oh, wait, I was wrong, I was like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
I had no idea. It completely surprised me.
Can I just point out that the big final action scene in this, which is like a down shuttle as water is rushing in over it, Harrison Ford's trapped inside, is one of the best shot things I've seen in, like, I don't know, forever.
Oh.
It's so gorgeous. I was just in the sound design for it, and pretty much everything about that whole sequence was like, God damn. I mean, I can't think of anything visually in this thing I would criticize at all.
Well, it has this style where the camera, it never feels static the way like a Wes Anderson movie does, but it's a very methodical film.
Mm-hmm.
It takes its time with every cut, with every edit, every angle. It lingers. And so when it gets into the action sequences, they have this staccato rhythm where crazy shit is happening on screen, but the camera is just so locked in on what's going on and unmoving that it keeps you centered. And so it's such a weird experience to have such an intense action scene be so calm.
Agreed. There is a sort of, like, this whole film has almost a sublime level of, like, zen-likeness to it. Even when it explodes into violence, it's so over so quickly, with the one exception of that final scene, which even then is almost kind of relaxing as the water is rushing in and out. And then but the one scene's really exception is the fight scene between Ryan Gosling and Harrison Ford, which is, they're surrounded by this, like, constantly interrupting, loud, garish Vegas light and sound show that is kind of startling.
It's easily the best sound design I've seen this year. And, like, I went on and on about how I felt Baby Driver had Academy Award winning sound design and mixing, and then I saw that sequence.
Because
you're right, it's like, you see Elvis in the background, it's big holographic displays everywhere, and you can tell, were this in the prime of Vegas time, you would hear the actual music, but because it's all shorted out, it's just this little, and it'll come in a little bit and go out, and it's, at the same time, there's also a gunfight going on and a fistfight. Although I will say, it blew me away those few times when you really see how strong Ryan Gosling and the robot are.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's a sequence right after that where Ryan Gosling just, like, walks through a marble wall.
Yeah.
Which, it ended up being jarring because I kept thinking of him as that real boy in the movie.
It's interesting to me as well that despite everything that Ridley Scott, who directed the original, has always said that, as far as I'm concerned, Riddick is, or not Riddick,
Decker.
Deckard is a replicant. This movie does not answer that question. It never says definitively that he is. In fact, every time you think that's what they're saying, they say something and think, well, maybe that's not what they're saying.
Oh, I disagree.
Really?
I thought it explicitly stated it.
Okay, no, I got that they did not explicitly
because, state I don't want to get into it because of possible spoilers, but yeah, there's a sequence, which we'll talk about offline, where I felt they were like, yeah, no, this is what we are.
Right. I know what you're talking about. I felt like they almost backtracked with saying, well, no, that's what the other person was.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. You know?
I don't know. I felt like at the very least it's vague enough that you still let the audience decide for themselves.
This is something that I kind of keyed onto while watching this, because this is the kind of movie that you think about bigger things while watching. So it's almost the antithesis of the original Blade Runner, because the original Blade Runner is this really epic world and tale that when you really think about it, it's this very small story of a guy just trying to hunt down four robots. That's it.
Yeah.
Whereas this movie it's ultimately about a super small thing, a guy trying to find a kid 30 years later. That is it. It is a missing persons case, but it's about so much more. Mm-hmm. And there's this huge world going on around it that's fascinating. And, you get the feeling that this is one small, tiny component of this epic saga that we'll never see, but is happening.
Yeah. I mean, I would love to see a film that's, 300 years later, and humans are dead.
Yeah.
They didn't make it. This film makes you feel like humans aren't going to make it. They're just not. As if Jared Leto's character is the only one who gets it.
Yeah.
They're not going to. These people, the only reason they're not more human is because you keep trying to build things into them to keep them from being human, but every other way, they're fucking human. You know, why not just let them finish their arc and become Homo superior.
I'd be into it, especially if Danny Villeneuve and Roger Deakins made it. Count me in.
Well, but anything they do together, I'm there. There was some of the extra feature stuff I was kind of disappointed with, and some I really liked. There's a 11 minutes Blade Runner 101, which is just EPKs about various aspects of the film.
Yeah,
and honestly, there's nothing there that's going to tell you anything you don't already know. The most interesting thing of a brand new thing was designing the world of Blade Runner, which is about 20 minutes long, and it gets really into making the props and the set design and everything, and the stuff that's actually, wow, that's really interesting, why they made the designs they did. I could have watched a full-length feature just about that aspect.
That's so fascinating about this movie, too, because it's so close, but so very distinct and different from the last one, too.
Agreed. There's 17 minutes on talking about the casting, which is, not as interesting. But honestly, the thing you want to watch, and a lot of people didn't even know this was out here, but it was on the internet. You could see it. I mean, you can see it now without even getting the disc, is the three prequels that were made and produced by Villeneuve. That made by different directors, two of which by Luke Scott, Ridley Scott's son, and one by a celebrated anime director Shinichiro Watanabe. The first one takes place in 2022, which is called Blackout, which shows what actually happened with as reference that period when there was a massive EMP and all of the digital information humanity had on the whole was destroyed. And so we kind of had to go, fuck, we don't have any records left. And that's the one, the anime one. And I'd say arguably the best of the three. It's pretty damn good. And then you have 2036 Nexus Dawn, which follows Jared Leto's character basically selling a small room of corporate types on the idea of being able to legally have replicants again in a kind of very jarring, startlingly violent sequence. And then you have 2048 Nowhere to Run, which is the really glad, this is the only one I hadn't seen before watching the Blu-ray disc of this. The character Sapper Morton, who we see only at the first sequence of the actual movie, played what's his face? Wrestling
Drax.
Guy. Drax.
Yeah.
What's his name? Why can't I
can't think of it either
right now. God damn it. I'm an idiot. I should know these things off
Dave Bautista.
Dave Bautista. And you get a little story and a little more action about him before this. How did they figure out where he was? And this is the story of that, where he gets to beat up some people and it's cool.
I gotta say, I'm intrigued because in the all of 3 minutes he was in, it was almost one of his best performances.
Yeah, it was super solid, and I kind of, the only sad thing is like, wow, I would watch a whole movie just about your character. I thought it was really interesting. Yeah, because
he plays an aging guy who... Yeah,
aging series 8, I want to say, or series 7, same replicant as series as Rachel and, and Roy Battery and shit.
I don't want to call him feeble.
Yeah.
Because he's not. He's still like,
but he's can old.
Walk through a wall.
They had to older him up some.
Older, more gentle. Yeah. Character, and that was really interesting.
He's just a farmer. He's a protein farmer. You know, he raises larvae.
And garlic. Let's
and has not a forget pet the garlic. Tree. Pet dead tree. Yeah, I love the shit out of this movie. Yeah. I will definitely watch and rewatch this movie.
Yeah.
I think it's an amazing work of art.
Same here. Like, it's the only real complaint I have is it's 3 hours long, and so... It's a commitment. But having said that...
But it doesn't feel...
I was going to say, it may be 3 hours long, but it's essential.
Yeah.
I can't sit here and go like, oh, yeah, you can lose this whole sequence.
I never feel the time when I'm watching it. It just is, you don't go, oh, I'll throw in a movie real quick. It's the length of two movies.
Exactly.
So you're like, okay, it is a commitment, and it's not something you're going to want to be having to deal with other stuff while you're watching. You want to put it on and watch it straight through with the sound up loud in a darkened room.
Yeah, with a big TV.
With the biggest TV you can find.
God, it's gorgeous.
It really is. The only thing I would say that would be better than this Blu-ray release is the 4K release, which I still don't have a 4K TV yet. Otherwise, I would ask for that. But, you know, I can only imagine how much more amazing the 4K version is than this one. All right, well, that brings us to the end of this week's Digital Noise. I want to thank Aaron for joining me again. The next show will be The Return of Joe. You guys haven't heard from him for a while.
What?
Yeah, I talked him into watching a stack of movies this week. Unfortunately, I felt so bad when I'm actually handing them off to him. I was like, oh, fuck, most of these aren't that good. But they're ones we'll have a lot of fun talking about with titles like Geostorm and Suburbicon.
Oh, God, that's why you watched Geostorm?
You don't think I watched it just for fun, did you?
I thought maybe it was a theatrical thing. I didn't know it was already on disc.
It's already on disc.
You were so mean to Joe.
I didn't mean to be. It just the way it shaked out. I thought I was thinking in my head, oh, I'm going to hand him. It's going to be a fun stack for me to hand him. I'll be happy. And I was like, as I'm handing him, I'm like, fuck.
Well, considering that the worst movie I saw was okay, thank you.
You're welcome. You did get set, like, pretty much the most solid set we've covered.
No shit. This is amazing.